Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you with the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by three very interesting guests. We're going to get to know more about them and their companies. Tasha Hawk from Y Scouts, welcome. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
And we also have with us Teresa Marzol from Culture Engineered. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for inviting me.
And Neil Mehta from Epifinder and Epibuild and many other ventures here in the Valley. Neil, welcome.
Thank you for having me this afternoon.
Tasha, tell us a little bit about Y Scouts. What do you do and how are you serving people?
Y Scouts is a leadership search firm, and we're on a mission to connect people to work that really matters for them. And so we're doing a number of things that disrupt traditional, ineffective recruiting and executive search to fulfill that mission. We support exclusively organizations with strong purpose, mission, and core values, and work to unite them with candidates who have passions aligned with those mission, purpose, core values so that they can drive the greatest positive impact for the world by the business that they're doing or the organizations they're serving.
Now, talk a little bit about the recruiting process. You say that it's broken. Statistics show that 50% of CEO placements end unsuccessfully after 18 months. Mm-hmm. What is going on? And what are you doing to fix that?
I think that's a really shocking statistic that not many people are aware of. We know at Y Scouts that's because those assessment and selection processes are not rooted in discovering the authentic core values held by an individual. And because of that, CEOs, when they're placed in roles and go up in a ball of flames in 18 months, they're not going sideways because they don't have the skills and capabilities. They're going sideways because they're in the wrong organization for them, the wrong culture. And by that, we mean values as demonstrated by behaviors.
Right, right. Let's talk a little bit more about that. We're going to dig into organizational culture with everyone in the studio today. What do you mean by organizational culture? And as an outsider looking to partner with organizations and individuals to create these perfect placements, what are you looking for?
The answer to that question is many things and shifting things depending on that organization that we're serving and the problems that they're trying to solve. And so when we talk about what is organizational culture, I'd love to hear your perspectives, Neil and Teresa, as well, because I think often that word is used to little effect. People talk about culture and they're not really talking about what they're doing, right? What their behaviors are showing, what they're achieving. They're talking about, you know, some things written on the wall that we walk by every day when we come into the office or some stuff that we printed on the back of a t-shirt, right?
Yes.
But that's not culture, right? Culture is how you behave, how you engage, and what impact you drive.
Teresa, let's just bring you into the conversation here. Your company is Culture Engineered.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about what you do, and then we'll talk more about this topic of culture.
Yeah. Culture Engineered offers employee feedback tools and services to small and mid-sized companies. So again, realizing that culture is kind of this non-quantifiable aspect of a business, this personality that you can kind of pick certain parts out, but how it comes together is really how it makes it very unique. We realized that the best way to work around that culture and to serve, deliver, and improve that culture is based in feedback, collecting feedback on how individuals feel about the culture, concerns they have, really, bringing in that communication in a strategic way, and then managing that feedback is the best way for companies to get the most out of their culture and not deviate, which you see a lot of companies do. Not overnight, but in little small corrections or not corrections, but little deviations over time. And you realize that high turnover, just a toxic environment, various symptoms of just a company that's stepped away from their culture.
You know, it's very interesting, Tasha. I heard in what you were saying a minute ago, the idea of culture as a verb. In other words, this is not something static. This is not a thing. Certainly not the slogans or the things on the wall. It's a set of practices. It's what you're doing and what your people are doing. So, Teresa, it's very interesting for me to hear you talk about feedback being an important category of the kind of things a company can do.
Mm-hmm.
Is this common, or is this something you often need to introduce to an organization?
It depends. There's still, I think everyone now realizes the importance of transparency, but that's still a lot of top-down communication. And so how to have transparency from a bottom up is still a really important part of a healthy culture, no matter what culture you subscribe to, because, as Tasha pointed out, they're different. It's different for everybody. But to not get feedback on how your changes, what you're doing, is impacting and being viewed by the individuals that are subscribing to that culture, that are a part of it, that are sometimes driving that culture or creating it and shaping it every day, I think is a dangerous move. So I do think it is the behaviors in which people conduct themselves. And then part of that is constantly checking on how is that perceived? Is this consistent with how you feel? Why or why not? We do it in marketing with consumers, with potential consumers. It's the same internally, but more important because they're driving the ship. These are the people touching, interacting with your customers every day to make sure that they still feel that they understand and represent. That culture is critical for any business's success.
There's so much to unpack here, and I want to really dig into these issues around communication, engagement, transparency, and so on. Neil, I want to bring you into the conversation. Your company, Epifinder, is also, in a way, engaged in a fundamental process of communication. You're a med tech company. Tell us about you and your work and your team and how you're serving folks.
My name is Neil. I'm a co-founder and chief operating officer at Epifinder Inc. We started this back in 2015 to really provide a diagnostic solution to complex and difficult to diagnose conditions. When we presented this concept to different doctors here in the community, they said that you should focus on epilepsy because it's one of the most complex and difficult to diagnose conditions. There are 65 million people worldwide who have epilepsy. 3.4 million people in US and 1 in 26 Americans will have epilepsy at any given point in their lifetime. And that costs the US healthcare system $36.8 billion each year.
That's not a drop in the bucket.
No.
That's real money.
That's real money. Money being spent on mismanagement, duplication of tests, lack of right type of diagnosis and things like that. So we built a framework, we built a diagnostic algorithm to allow and empower a doctor to triage patients effectively and identify whether or not they have epilepsy, first of all. And second, if they have epilepsy, then which type of epilepsy they have, because there are 62 different types. So that's where a lot of complexity in terms of diagnosing comes into the play. You know, as a founder, I can say all day long that I have the best company, the best product out in the market. But we wanted to get it proved by a leading institution here in the Valley. So we partnered with Mayo Clinic here in Phoenix, Arizona, and we did a randomized clinical study last year for 6 months, and the results came out to be phenomenal, nothing short but the best. So the current rate of correct diagnosis is about 60%, but with our tool, now it is 86.8. Mm-hmm. So we are improving the clinical diagnosis by over 50% in comparison, and by over 26.8% to be kind of the difference. And so that has led us to now look into commercializing the tool. And we are working on FDA approval and making sure that we can go forward and really bring this tool to the marketplace and empower doctors and improve people's life at the end of the day.
Now, your tool is essentially a form of patient-doctor communication, isn't
it? That's
correct. It's not a diagnostic tool that is taking a blood sample or some other form of physical sample. So you have designed a way for patients to provide feedback as part of the diagnosis process. This is why I thought some of these overlaps would be interesting, even though it's a very different environment. Teresa, a minute ago, you talked about how feedback tools really allow for transparency from the bottom up in an organization. Neil, the relationship between patients and providers has gotten strained, right? You gave a keynote last year that I know a little bit about. We did some work on it together, actually. I was fascinated when you compared what it was like to visit a doctor in the 19th century versus what it's like today. Can you talk a little bit about what's changed and why your diagnostic tool or communication tool is so critical?
Sure. So back in the day, doctor would take time and they would write a story on every patient who will walk into a clinic or a hospital. And it will start with something like, once upon a time, I met this lady or this gentleman and their name was X, Y, and Z. And they'll spend about 30 to 45 minutes up to an hour really understanding. And all they will have is a paper and a pen and two human beings in the room. And that has completely transformed in this 21st century now. Now doctors have to click 20 times on each patient. They have to document everything what they're doing. They have less than 5 minutes to be spent on each patient because every hospital and clinic is trying to maximize how many patients that they can see. Also, there is a long wait list. So hospitals and clinics are not to be blamed because they also want to serve people and also keep the profit margin and hit the bottom line. So there is a lot of nuances which is going on. And also the culture which we were talking about recently is that doctors back in the day were used to taking time and they were the actual owner of what to do with the patient care. But now with all this tools and services and regulations, they have to really think carefully before they prescribe anything. So what has happened is there is not much innovation in the marketplace. It's more about making sure that they are doing what we call CYA, is covering the butt, you know, to make sure that they are not being penalized by the insurance companies. And so a tool like EpiFinder empowers patients to take ownership of their health. So when they are at home, when they are watching a movie, having a dinner, now they can input everything what they are feeling or they are having it in the not only the mental space, but the physical being. And then they can transmit that information to the doctor. So a doctor is simply collecting that information. So by the time a patient goes and sees that doctor, now the doctor is not worried about, okay, I have to make this 20 clicks or I have to ask this like 10 mundane questions. It's more individualized care. They are focused on, okay, you have already given me all this information. What else am I missing? Are you sure that this was correct? And it's more one-on-one conversation rather than just documentation.
Tasha, you describe a process that must involve a lot of communication. And there's a lot of different stakeholders in the process. And as I just think about the resonances, again, a very different context of some of the things Neil is talking about in doctor-patient relations, as you're navigating this landscape between clients, between, you know, the organizations and the people who are seeking positions and really finding that match, talk a little bit about how that unfolds. What are the sorts of organizations you tend to work most with and what's unique about the way you help solve this problem?
Yep. And I really appreciate that. And I want to give presence to, you know, Neil talking about that empowerment that that feedback provides, the connection that Teresa and I were even talking in the lobby earlier about the connection that leads to the manifestation of culture. And so as you had asked earlier, at Y Scouts, one of the things that we do quite differently to operationalize our and our clients' prioritization of purpose and values is we lead with a covert approach, and we kind of lovingly and laughingly call it that, where we don't immediately disclose who our client is, what role we're trying to fill, because we're trying to mitigate that natural human tendency to try to make ourselves appear what we hope that that organization or that hiring leader wants us to be and represent our authentic selves, that real candidate behind the resume. And so we talk with our candidates about their core values, what's most important to them as a foundation for the entire assessment and selection process. On the other side, on the client-facing side, we engage very differently by what we like to call fanatical preparation for radical alignment. And what that means is that we'll take a little bit of a pause at the beginning of a process to really get to know that client, what their culture is, who they're looking for. And our services help them identify and then effectively articulate that in a really new way. And so we use a couple of tools. We use an organizational DNA assessment. So back, Teresa, to that kind of bottom up, keeping the finger on the pulse of what is really happening in the organization. And so we ask a set of questions of a diverse population within the organization about what it's really like to be there. What happens when you fail? How often do you get feedback? When's the last time you saw your core values in action? And we use that to build not only our understanding of someone who would function well. We like to put our candidates in places where their hearts will really sing so that they can drive amazing impact. But it also allows us to represent that organization externally to the candidates when we do disclose the information so that they can really make choices about, yes, I really want to raise my hand for this, or self-select out of, that doesn't sound like the kind of culture. Those kinds of core values don't resonate with me, so I'm going to wait for something else. And then lastly, we work with the team, taking a variety of inputs from key stakeholders on the client side who have a perspective about what success this role should help drive for the organization. So tossing out those ridiculous bias-inducing job descriptions, and we can talk more about that later if you'd like, and focusing on a definition of the role that is rooted in articulating what are the key success outcomes, what are the responsibilities within those, what are the evidence points that allow us to understand, and then engaging in a really meaningful conversation with those candidates who now have transparency, as Teresa said, into understanding what the organization is really like. Good, bad, ugly, things we know we need to change, things we don't know about yet, and make really conscious decisions about whether or not we or they or the client want to move them forward in the process.
I'm fascinated by the degree to which all three of you are involved in a process of making things visible that are often unseen. And the core idea is then, of course, you can make better decisions, better diagnoses, better placements when you can see things that oftentimes live in a blind spot or live in the unsaid of an organization. You're absolutely right. Job descriptions are written from some strange place of idealized requirements as well as roles, right? And the reality of the position is going to be different. And of course, when a job seeker shows up in her first day, she's finding that the stuff that really matters wasn't ever described or experienced in some way. And, you know, backing up a step or two in the interview process, she's putting on her best face and everyone's kind of trying to bluster their way through it. The company wants to attract the best possible talent, so they're on their best behavior. And of course, the candidates are looking for the best outcome for themselves personally and professionally. And it's fascinating the degree to which people can end up in really unhappy situations because all sides were trying to impress each other instead of telling the truth.
Yep. Yeah, it's true. And I think one of the other things that we do very purposefully at Y Scouts is not over coach our candidates. And so a lot of the more traditional firms will invest a lot of time in trying to rewrite a resume or reframe how someone represents their experience in a way that they believe will be more palatable to the client. And we very consciously disengage from that practice because we want that person to authentically show up at themselves. And I often use my own personal example where when I am considering joining a new organization, I make sure that they know I have full sleeves of tattoos, because if that's going to be a problem at the beginning, it's never going to work. And if they don't want me with all of my inky glory, then I kind of don't want to be there either.
Yeah, really great example, really powerful point. And of course, that's something visible. And there's also so many things that are invisible, purpose, values, commitments. And yet those are the things that when someone feels like they're flourishing in a role, they feel like those are the things that are in alignment with the organization. Teresa, you use a number of different tools. You're actively involved in the nitty gritty of this. Talk a little bit about what you see companies doing well and areas of opportunity. What makes or breaks this feedback and the process internally to an organization?
I think one thing that companies are doing well that we're seeing more of is the use of tools. And it was so interesting, Neil, when you were talking about, you know, the data and information, but then it's given to the doctor. I think, you know, it's not WebMD where people are trying to solve their own ailments and solve people problems with the tool itself. You use the tool to capture data and give it to the experts to manage that data, all of what that means. So I think there's a lot of great technology out there now and tools that are helping companies manage their challenges, manage their people and their strategies around people. But I think, unfortunately, it's stopping there a lot of times. People think they can solve it with that data. And data itself doesn't solve the problem, obviously. You should do something with that data. So I think the good part, though, with companies introducing these new technologies, you know, surveys, different things that companies are doing, most companies will do exit interviews, not good exit interviews, but they do exit interviews. They're capturing information. They realize the importance, but then it stops. It stops and you look at it through a rear view mirror window. It's not really being used in real time, and it's not, no one's giving context to a lot of that data, which is where companies can improve drastically. And I think we see this in other places as well. And like I said, Neil, you touched on it, on a doctor-patient relationship. And you, Tasha, talked about it as far as you guys use tools and use that to then say, okay, now we're going to match you. If you just put the data from the tools out there, likely that wouldn't do much for you or for your clients or the candidates. And so I think right now that's where especially small and mid-sized businesses with between 50 and 300 employees are really struggling, is missing that link of now here's where we are. What does that mean for us moving forward? It's a lot of good intentions. I think a lot of, you know, CEOs, leaders in general have great intentions. But unfortunately, the employee experience has become one of habit. We recruit the same way. We onboard the same way. We get the same benefits for everybody. We do training and development. We send people to workshops. We do performance appraisals the same way. Everything is this very unauthentic, template, cookie cutter approach to employment. And then you wonder, well, why aren't my employees engaged? Well, they could have potentially the same experience down the street with your competitor or someone in a totally different industry because it's the same experience as an employee. So I think using that information to make their experience different in your organization is critical. You know, when you think about it, over a lifetime, a third of your life is spent at work. It better be good. Like that's, you're choosing to go to work versus be with your friends and family that aren't work, you know, related, or go on vacation or stay at home and watch TV or play video games or whatever. You're choosing to go to work. And so it needs to be a valuable experience to bring value to that job, no matter what it is. Growing up, my mom was a maid. She cleaned houses for people. She loved the difference it made in someone's, you know, the day that she came, people were ecstatic. She's cleaning toilets. You know, this isn't a glamorous job, but she did it because she loved that they have a better week because she was there. Now they can spend more time together. Now they can, you know, it allowed her a lifestyle of, you know, she was a single mom, so she could, you know, manage her schedule to be at home with us if we were sick. These are things that made her do her job well, even though it's cleaning your toilet. So I think, you know, it doesn't have to be this exceptional job as far as a title and all this stuff. It needs to be an exceptional experience. And every leader, every company can make that happen.
What's one thing? Give us a practical takeaway. What's something, if an organization wants to impact their culture, wants to elevate their people, what's one thing they can do that they're probably not doing or that they need to do better?
Okay. So I think one simple thing, so people a lot of times will say, well, you know, I don't even know where to start or what to do. We don't want to do a survey, which is, you know, that's fine. It's just more difficult this way, really, but it sounds more simple. Ask people what their best day was at the job and what their worst day was at the job and why. And shut up. Just listen to why. It will amaze you the things that they say. It's probably not the day you gave them a bonus. They forgot that day, the day after you gave them that bonus. Mm-hmm. Or it's probably not the day they got their insurance card that you spend tens of thousands of dollars on every year. It's probably a day that maybe someone was telling me the other day, oh man, I got this certification. It's up on my wall. I just think it's so awesome. It's a piece of paper and everyone took 5 seconds to applaud. It's something simple, or it can be the simplest things. My sister-in-law works for a great company, makes great salary benefits. What was the first thing she told me about when she came home from her first day? Oh my gosh, they have breakfast for us every day. It's so awesome. Are you kidding? It's a continental breakfast. Ask them what their best day was, what their worst day was, and why. You ask that, you get a lot of valuable information on why people come in on a day, you know, that they'd prefer to be home. And then why they can be so happy in the morning and leave just feeling like they had their stomach ripped out of them or something, or a soul-sucking day. Right. In each of their stories, and you'll see trends with that too.
Yeah, for sure. Neil, you've gone a very different route. Talk a little bit about your journey and why you decided to co-found a company instead of seeking a position in an established organization, and some of the things you've learned along the way. And of course, you've got a team of people working with you. So some of these dynamics are very real in your day-to-day experience executing on your mission. Talk about that journey.
I was a graduate student at Arizona State University pursuing biomedical informatics. My entire goal was to graduate, apply for a postdoc position, become a faculty at the university, and life is all good. You have 401k, you have all that great benefits, and you are teaching students. You are advancing science. I felt that was the best way to contribute and, you know, be a part of the community and advance the science and tech and engineering behind that. But then when I actually started seeing my peers who will design and build great innovative like technological solutions for Parkinson's or for Alzheimer's, they will present that in front of the committee to get their master's or PhD. And then I'll see, literally they will like close the book, put it in the shelf, and then I'll ask, what's next? They'll, well, I got a 6-figure salary job at Amazon and I'll be software developing the cart where the consumers will put the products in. And I'm like, is there anything relevance between what you did for the past 5 years, learning more about healthcare, biomedical stuff, and what you build? And they're like, yeah, but I don't know what to do with this. I don't know how I can take my concept and bring it to the market. I don't want to build a team. I don't know how to lead a team. I'm a scientific researcher. So I was like, apply for the job in a hospital. Oh, they don't pay well. And so that was a big disconnect. The second disconnect which I saw was, it takes 17 years for any academic ideas to come to the market. And only 14% of those ideas actually gets into the hands of the users. And I was like, this has to change. And so at that time, I was dabbling about entrepreneurship and marketing and business and seeing what can I do when the state, the university is contributing so much capital resources to educate and train me as a professional. I came across an entrepreneurship program at ASU, and it was evenings from 6 to 8 p.m. twice a week. And the best thing was there was free food. So I was like, yeah, as a student, I was hungry and, you know, I'll be like, okay, I'm getting something for free. Also, there is a food. Why don't I just go and sit and see? And there were the CEOs from different companies who were teaching us how they went about in their life. And I was like, wow, this is fascinating. If they can do it, I can do it. And so at that time, I had a different startup. We scaled it, sold it. And then I was looking for the next concept. And that's where I got acquainted with my co-founder, who was literally sitting right next to my cubicle for 3 years. But in academia, you don't talk to your fellow beings. You just do what you are doing. And that's collaboration. And so we started talking and I said, you know, you have this complex algorithm. I just sold my previous business. How about we team up together? I'll help you scale it. Anyways, I want to pursue more biomedical concepts and information. And then we can see where it goes. And so we applied to SeedSpot, which is a social incubator here in downtown Phoenix. Got selected, launched Business 101, then applied to the ASIUS Foundation Entrepreneurship Program at Skysong here in Scottsdale, got selected, and then started forming a team. And all the things what you both are saying is really relevant to us, because when we started, we had no idea about who to hire and what to do. Everything was on the piece of paper and a napkin concept. And so we started like putting out flyers and fillers to ASU's computer science department, to business department, to biological sciences, and said that we are looking for student interns for this creative concept. We don't know whether it will work or not, and we don't know how to manage them. And slowly some of the students started applying. And for our first summer internship program, which we formally announced, we got 120 resumes in 2 weeks from all across ASU, U of A, and Grand Canyon University. And I was like, perfect, solution done. You know, now we'll scale like there is no business on the planet. So I went through each resume going line by line, invited about 50 of them for the interviews, selected 12, thinking, okay, maybe one or two will quit. We'll have 10 people for the summer. We'll have our first prototype done. Some software developers, some business guys, some research guys to advance epilepsy research. Within 2 weeks, everyone quit but one. And I was just left the way we started. And I was like, what went wrong? There has to be a better way to recruit people. So once again, both Robert and I, as we are, we just like to build something on our own. We started like putting things, and we actually asked people who quit, why did you leave? What was wrong with us? Was I that I was like, I didn't speak English? So, but then we realized that it was not that the concept or the project was wrong. It was different expectation which was being put forward in the form of a polished roles and responsibility compared to what they had to do, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. The environment, the vibe, someone wanted to get paid, we didn't have funds, things like that. So there was a lot of things which went behind the scenes. So the last 18 months, we started working on perfecting that. We call it EPI assessment, which is an internal product which we are also designing and building. So as you guys are talking about, I thought that I'll just give a plug on that. And what we do is we essentially give a link to anyone who applies. So right now we get about 40 to 45 resumes a month, just word of mouth, organic form of marketing across university campuses, entry-level jobs and experience jobs, what we are looking for. Even if you are like the top-level executive on another startup, you have to go through that assessment. All of our contractors go through it. All of our employees go through it. All of our advisors also have to go through that assessment. It takes about 2 hours. And I know that in this day and age, no one has 2 hours to sit down and like answer those questions. And it is nothing technical, no research, no development question. It's all about attitude, aptitude, personality, dynamic team relationships, building startup culture. And just talking about our story from the journey which we have gone through, and then asking them, are you open to joining us? And then giving them a clear expectation as to what it would look like for them. Out of like 40 resumes, which we get about 10 each month, will complete the assessment. And one of the internal HR person will review them and color code them green, yellow, and all red, just like the traffic signal, to identify who we are interviewing and why, and then where that candidate looks like. And then we'll invite them. Potentially all the green ones get selected automatically unless they don't show up on time and they don't screw up the interview. By doing this, our culture and our retention rate and our team dynamics have improved significantly. We have over 80% retention right now, which I'm grateful and very glad about. But yes, it took a long journey to go about doing that. It took a long journey to not to have paycheck coming every 2 weeks and sometimes even putting my own money to get the company going. So I've gone through highs and lows over the last 3 years to bring about where EpiFinder has come to.
Thanks for sharing that with us. It's striking in your story how much that move required an openness and a willingness to look and see what are potentially we doing or not doing that's contributing to this. Tasha, you must see a lot of different types of clients with a lot of different needs. It's a little bit easier if you're in a leadership role at the hiring organization. You can just set the tone and say, this is how we're going to do it. What do you see that folks are doing really well? And what are some of the gaps and areas that people are just simply not aware is important in these kind of leadership search roles?
One of the things that we know, and I'd love, Neil, I'd love to learn more about your algorithm and also your definition of what it means to mess up an interview if you're a green signal person. I'd like to know what happens there. As we are looking for leaders aligned for organizations, one of the things that we know is across all tenures, all industries, all functions within an organization, there are three elements that help us understand someone's capabilities to be a leader. And those are drives results, develops others, and learns relentlessly. And within those, again, there's a lot packed into that seemingly simple package. For instance, learns relentlessly. That's really about not only innate curiosity, wondering, asking what if, but it's also a little bit around allowing people to, back to the authentic, be your authentic self, in a culture where you can exhibit vulnerability in a way that allows you to access, receive, and leverage feedback effectively. And so I think that's something that many leaders aren't mindful of, is how do you imbue your culture, as evidenced by the core values put into action through your behaviors? How do you demonstrate that and give other people access to that? We're so lucky with the clients that we get to serve. And many of them are part of the Conscious Capitalism Institute's network or are B Corps. We ourselves are a B Corp. Even in those organizations, allowing yourself and your leadership to take that pause to invest in the process of discovery around what is the organizational DNA, what is revealed by that role visioning exercise, and investing in your future success by taking the time to do those things. Because, and all of my colleagues know it's my favorite number, if we're going to take off at 11 bazillion miles an hour to try to find your hire, because most people aren't hiring in advance of need, they're hiring because of need, and we don't take the time to really accurately line up on the target, we're going to end up 3 months from now equidistant from the solution as when we started. And so I think for leaders, allowing themselves to take that time, invest that time, and recognize the value of that time to really align with a strong partner. And then lastly, I think that many organizations, particularly new organizations, are neglecting the early foundational work around articulating a competency model. And so that spans both functional skills and capabilities, as well as those core values elements, looking at who can be successful, who has been successful, and who do we want to be successful? Because that will also help you engage with issues related to inclusion and diversity. And if you're really conscious of those things, you're conscious of, okay, what's been tripping people up in their performance? Do we need to learn how to be better leaders? Do we need to build that muscle of how to give and receive feedback? Figuring out what those competencies are, where your opportunities are, and working with talent management, not as an HR function, but as a business function, to help build those skills to positively impact the bottom line.
I'm fascinated by some recurring questions that happen over and over, whether it's in science and technology, whether it's in social sciences, the enduring question of, is it the individual or is it the environment? Is it biology or is it culture? I'm struck with a question, can good culture, whatever that means, we can probably unpack that a little bit, can good culture overcome a quote unquote bad hire at the top? Which determines, now of course this is a silly question because the answer to all of them is always, well, it's both and it depends.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, in some ways, culture starts at the top. People tend to align themselves in a hierarchical environment with what they see happening at the top. And at the same time, culture does not take place only at the top. Culture lives every day in the actions people take in their own teams and in their own departments and in their own environments. So we've got a really complex phenomenon here. And one of your organization's stated competencies is to really uniquely approach the question of fit.
Yeah.
So which is more important, finding the right candidate or the right client.
I'd actually like to take that just one click back to that word fit, which I think is a really important word to give presence to. And so I think many organizations use the word, you know, well, they weren't a fit, as code for they're kind of not like us. And so making sure that when you hear that coming up in your hiring process, that you really force yourselves and your colleagues to nail down, what do you mean by that? If you mean they don't look or act or think like we do, then we got a problem. Inclusion and diversity is exceptionally important, and hiring for fit can really undermine that and have negative impact on a business or an organization's mission. Related to issues of inclusion and diversity in your hiring process, as with any integrated talent management ecosystem in your organization, you need to understand, can I recognize diversity? Can I appreciate it? And then can I leverage it to mutual benefit? And so when you're talking about fit, you just have to be really careful that you're not introducing homogeneity and that you're using an assessment and selection process to include people rather than exclude. And so I know that didn't exactly answer your subsequent question.
Well, it's a better answer than it was a question, probably. I think that you're pointing to such a fascinating area of this, and that is, it not only could have a suppressive effect on inclusion and diversity, but also on innovation. Mm-hmm. If you're only hiring the company man, people who fit and who are trying to fit in will not contribute the kind of thinking necessary, and particularly in an innovation-driven company, mm-hmm. That could be a problem. Neil, how do you navigate this landscape between finding people for whom working in this environment is aligned in some way with your mission and theirs, and at the same time, get people who can still think outside of the box enough that they're pushing the innovation that you're looking for in your products and in your platform?
One of the things I always look for is that if any of my team members always says, Neil, I agree with you, I feel that, okay, they're not trying to push the envelope. They are just trying to be an employee who is looking to get brownie points at the end of each day. So I always challenge my team members that, okay, what's missing here? Or what else can we do together to build an app or develop this platform, things like that. Another thing which is very critical is I hire people which are smarter than me, and I know that they can replace me any day if they want to. That's a great thing for me, because every day I'm thinking is what else I can delegate or empower someone on my team to do so that I'm not doing the things the same way I was doing the things the day before. So I follow a simple principle of 3 Ds, do, delegate, drop. That's how I'm able to manage all the projects within my organization. And also challenging my team members. So if they say no, that it cannot be done, I just don't take no for an answer. I do the Toyota A3 model of 5 whys and just go into the grassroots and seeing if it is a skill set issue or if it is just that they're not invested enough. All the full-time employees we have, they also have stock options. So they know that they are getting the biweekly paycheck. But in order for them to really be involved in, they have to push the company forward, because when the company moves forward, they will be able to get that incentive of selling their stocks at some point in their lifetime. And so that is also a benefit of me focusing on a win-win-win scenario rather than just trying to keep all the pie to myself.
I'm intrigued by the fact that you're building more than just the software, the technology, the apps that you have at EpiFinder. You're building the team that's building the stuff. And you also have another offshoot of this called EpiBuild. So what is that all about? Give us the thumbnail overview of your newest venture.
As a startup founder, the first thing you have to learn from your mentor's advisor is to say no to 99 things and just yes to one thing. Every day. I kept doing that over the past 3 years, and we were just focused on EpiFinder. But as we formed the team, we got the Mayo Clinic validation completed. Grateful enough that I've been featured to be 35 entrepreneurs under 35 and 40 under 40 by Phoenix Business Journal. EpiFunder got Tech Startup of the Year recognition last year, and so on and so forth. So a lot of fellow entrepreneurs, people who have ideas, will connect with me on LinkedIn or meet me at different events, or if I'm presenting at a conference, and they say, how can I go about this? Because when I go to a software development company or when I go to a marketing agency, they all say it will cost them $20,000 plus to just initialize or do the product roadmap and understand about their ideas. And
you're talking about for an app?
For an app, okay. Right, for an app. So people who have ideas to build an app, or people who already have an app or a product, but they need some marketing help. And I'll give them like 30 to 45 minutes of like just tips and tricks and tactics as a part of giving back to the community, because a lot of people have given to me. And so I can do what I can, or I will do the introductions. But about 3 months ago, my developers, again, I love them, because they said, Neil, we are getting bored. We are done. And the reason is, with EpiFinder, we are at version 3.3.2. Now the adoption cycle is taking place with various hospitals where we are launching and putting the apps together and platform together. And with the new FDA rule, which just came about 30 days ago, now we need FDA approval. The good news is we'll get it in 90 days. But the bad news is there is no company who have ever done before, because it's a digital app, right? It's not a device or a drug. So we are going through that process and doing that. So while we are going through that, our development team had some moments on their hand, and then I get all this request from people in the community. So I was like, how about we team up in a way where they don't have to spend $20,000 to test their idea. Spend less than like $5,000, figure it out, let's build a prototype. They can go talk to their customers, stakeholders, just like how we did, but at a fraction of a cost, because we want their ideas to come to life. We want their thought processes or their wish, you know, just like it takes me back to my department where I had fellow graduate students and they said, I don't know how to do it. I don't have funds, but I really want to pursue it, and they will take up a job. I don't want people to do that. I want their ideas to figure out in less than $5,000, in less than 6 weeks, whether it will work or not. Either take it or shoot it, but don't just be in that mindset. I will do it someday. I'll do it someday. So that's where we come into the play, where we provide a custom software application development opportunity for them to come to our office, have a brainstorming session. We design, build everything in-house in Scottsdale, Arizona. We don't outsource to China, where it can be copied, or Ukraine, where you don't know who is working on your app, but while providing a fraction of a cost so that they can afford and take that leap of faith.
That's fabulous. And where can people learn more about you, Neil, about EpiFinder, and about EpiBuild?
Follow me on LinkedIn, Neil Mehta, Healthcare Futurist. Or you can email me at Neil, N-E-E-L, at epifinder.com. The websites are epifinder.com, epibuild.com, epiassessment.com.
Thank you so much. Teresa, as you look forward, what are you excited by? What's on the horizon for you and for Culture Engineered?
We turn 2 in February, so that's pretty exciting. So it's an exciting month. So we're doing some special things around that. We're really working a lot this year, focusing. I forget how lonely leadership can be, struggling to make payroll, or, you know, if you're going to have to do layoffs and it's gut wrenching. I think there's nothing more lonely than going through a lawsuit from an own existing or former employee. So these things can be really lonely, even when things are good and you're anxious at night as the leader thinking about, but will it stay this way? Even the good times, I think, can be lonely. I forget that, and that's something that I was hearing more from clients. And of course, I can say, I have another client going through the same thing. And I realized it's really about that community, I think, that, you know, leaders can provide one another. I know myself, I belong to a group, and I call it therapy, because it's just, I'm going to talk about today, this thing happened, and I just don't know what I'm going to do. These moments of just, you know, it feels like your life is just going too fast or just at a dead stop. But those moments, I think, are so important to, especially in good, with good leaders trying to make a difference in their product and service or for their people, which it should be both. It can be taxing. So in 2019, there will be more of a focus on bringing culture engineered clients and leaders together, just offering them those supports. So we did, I did with a colleague of Tasha's, I did a panel. I think like that, for example, talking about our good stories, obviously, but really allowing for more of those intimate sharing of ideas and those moments of, yes, oh, I went through that, because I think that that's one amazing thing when you tell your worst day, someone else that maybe is a little further ahead says, yeah, I remember that. That sucks. But then this happens, or, you know, there is this idea of, oh, this is where I'm headed. That's fine. This is normal. So I think aside from providing for a better community for employees to go to work in their workplaces, definitely for leaders to, you know, share ideas and discuss how, you know, they can be better leaders by being more humble, open, and honest with each other. And then that allowing them to go back into it. And we were talking a little bit, Tasha, before we went on today, about the same concept of, you know, a humble leader, an honest leader is the best leader. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, when everyone's looking to you, whether it be your family or workplace, and you know, everyone's looking to you to come up with ideas, it's a little scary to say, I don't know, or I'm scared, or I'm not sleeping because this is happening. To have a place where you can share that, I think, is something that 2019 will be a big focus.
That's awesome. There's not just silos within organizations, but within entire industries, and fighting loneliness across, you know, while maintaining, of course, confidentiality and everything else, you have a unique perspective into so many different companies and so many different organizations, and using that in a way that can help connect people in a meaningful way outside of the scope of what they hired you for is a real great contribution. Teresa Marzal from Culture Engineered, how can people learn more about you and about your services?
You can go to cultureengineered.com and find more out about us on our website. You can also on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. You can find us and engage with us. We have an events page, so find out where we'll be. Come to events if you're looking to find out more about the culture engineered approach to things. It is a little bit non-traditional in the aspect of putting culture before all else and letting that kind of dictate where you move forward. Find us, and we have an event coming up, a couple in March, I think. For the rest of February, it's a little calm, but March it picks up.
Thank you, Teresa, for being here today. Tasha, you didn't talk much about your background, but I see in your bio that you come at this from a unique perspective with a degree in fine arts. How does that inform your people work and your approach to the problems that you solve at Y-Scouts?
It's a great question. And yeah, I have, my degrees are in sculpture. From basic qualifications, I can weld. So I got that going for me. I think in terms of how that informs what we get to do at Y-Scouts and the clients and the candidates that we get to support, it helps me and us take that innovative approach that we've talked about, right? We haven't walked the path so many times that we've worn this psychic groove that defines and constricts our approach to helping our clients solve problems. And so bringing that, as well as a curiosity for what can be built that I think resonates with values and purpose-aligned organizations, a lot of startups, right, to have that curiosity about what if, and that kind of default to yes, let's try. I think those sensibilities, those seeds were sown during my fine arts education. I know you didn't ask me about this, but I did. I was thinking, Teresa, when we were in the lobby before you got here, Neil, we were talking about culture and the fact that many organizations feel like culture is something that they get to and that it's set. The cake is baked. And I think what we all know is that culture is constantly evolving, constantly changing, constantly shifting. And talent acquisition is really interestingly at the fulcrum of that, because you're responsible not only for representing accurately and inspirationally the existing culture of the organization, but you're also bringing in people who are going to inform and shift that culture as they come in. And so it's really this delicious intersection of what is and what can be. And I think that's kind of part of the sensibility too, and what's so delightful about having a conversation with you and Teresa and Neil about this topic.
That's great. And what's on the horizon? What are you excited about?
I'm excited about a lot. At Y Scouts, we're really working on building out our practices. And so we have a really strong technology practice. We have a really strong nonprofit and social impact practice. And we have a lot of excellent serving across operations, manufacturing, finance, accounting, legal, in all those practices. And so bringing those communities together in the Y Scouts leadership community and activating them. We're also beginning to offer some things that we're realizing are gaps for our clients, things like interviewer training, how few organizations actually invest in helping people become great interviewers. And so we're developing solutions like that that can help continue to elevate our clients' ability to attract and retain and maximize the contributions of the great people they bring on board.
Marvelous. I think that's a much needed contribution. The art of the interview and of the engaging conversation is, of course, something that's near to my heart. It's what we do here at Business Radio X. It's also what I do professionally, is help people tell better stories and ask better questions. Because fundamentally, in my view, the quality of your life, your work, your relationships is a function of the questions you ask yourself and others and the stories you tell yourself and others. Tasha, where can people learn more about you and about Y Scouts?
Y Scouts is at Y Scouts, the letter Y, scouts.com. You can find us also on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter. And then if you're interested in lots of photographs of knitting and yarn, you can find me on Instagram at Tasha Hawk.
I love it. That's great. Teresa Marzal from Culture Engineered, Neil Madoc from Epifinder and Epibuild, Tasha Hawk from Y Scouts. It's been a delightful conversation. I want to thank you for joining us here in the studio and sharing your insights and your experience with the world. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us. Yes.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. And for all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.